This is Tana Hartman. I'm with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and welcome to the Wilf Show. We're coming to you from WCOM Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This morning, our guest was supposed to be Steve Deer, a People of Faith Against the Death Penalty. Unfortunately, he had an unavoidable conflict, and we'll get him in here another time. Instead, I'm going to read to you from an article that I found some time ago in Orion Magazine. It was written by Wendell Berry. He's an American poet and a farmer. He lives up in Kentucky, and he has been a very astute observer of what's been happening in this country for many years now. The title of this article was published in November-December 2004 issue of Orion Magazine, and the title of the article is Compromise Hell. Economic WMDs are being used against our own people in a version of freedom that makes greed the dominant economic virtue. We are destroying our country. I mean our country, ourself, our land. This is a terrible thing to know, but it's not a reason for despair unless we decide to continue the destruction. If we decide to continue the destruction, that will not be because we have no other choice. This destruction is not necessary. It is not inevitable, except that by our submissiveness, we make it so. We Americans are not usually thought to be a submissive people, but of course we are. Why else would we allow our country to be destroyed? Why else would we be rewarding its destroyers? Why else would we all, by proxies we've given to greedy corporations and corporate politicians, be participating in its destruction? Most of us are still too sane to piss in our own cistern, but we allow others to do so, and we even reward them for it. We reward them so well, in fact, that those who piss in our system are wealthier than the rest of us. How do we submit? By not being radical enough, or by not being thorough enough, which is the same thing. Since the beginning of the conservation effort in our country, conservationists have too often believed that we could protect the land without protecting the people. This has begun to change, but for a while yet, we will have to reckon with the old assumption that we can preserve the natural world by protecting wilderness areas while we neglect or destroy the economic landscapes, the farms, ranches, and working forests, and the people who use them. That assumption is understandable in view of the worsening threats to wilderness areas, but it is wrong. If conservationists hope to save even the wild lands and wild creatures, they're going to have to address issues of economy, which is to say issues of the health of the landscapes and the towns and the cities where we do our work, and the quality of that work and the well-being of the people who do the work. Governments seem to be making the opposite error, believing that people can be adequately protected without protecting the land. And here I'm not talking about parties or party doctrines, but about the dominant political assumption. Sooner or later, governments will have to recognize that if the land does not prosper, nothing else can prosper for very long. We can have no industry or trade or wealth or security if we don't uphold the health of the land and the people and the people's work. It's merely a fact that the land here and everywhere is suffering. We have the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and undrinkable water to attest to the toxicity of our agriculture. We know that we are carelessly and wastefully logging our forests. We know that soil erosion, air and water pollution, urban sprawl, the proliferation of highways and garbage are making our lives always less pleasant, less healthful, less sustainable, and our dwelling places more ugly. Nearly 40 years ago, the state of Kentucky, like other coal-producing states, began an effort to regulate strip mining. While that effort has continued and has imposed certain requirements of reclamation, strip mining has become steadily more destructive of the land and the land's future. We now permit the destruction of entire mountains and entire watersheds. No war so far has done such extensive or such permanent damage. If we know that coal is an exhaustible resource, whereas the forests over it are, with proper use, inexhaustible, and that strip mining destroys the forest virtually forever. How can we permit this destruction? If we honor at all that fragile creature, the topsoil, so long in the making, so miraculously made, so indispensable to all life, how can we destroy it? If we believe, as so many of us profess to do, that the earth is God's property and is full of His glory, how can we do harm to any of it? In Kentucky, as in other unfortunate states, and again at great public cost, we have allowed, in fact, we've officially encouraged, the establishment of the confined animal feeding industry, which exploits and abuses everything involved, the land, the people, the animals, and the consumers. If we love our country, as so many of us again profess to do, how can we so desecrate it? But the economic damage is not just confined to our farms and forests. For the sake of job creation, for instance in Kentucky and in other backward states, we have lavished public money on corporations that come in and stay only so long as they can exploit people here more cheaply than elsewhere. The general purpose of the present economy is to exploit, not to foster or conserve. Look carefully, if you doubt me, at the centers of the larger towns in virtually every part of our country. You'll find they're economically dead or dying. Good buildings that used to house needful, useful, locally owned small businesses of all kinds are now empty or have evolved into junk stores or antique shops. But look at the houses, the churches, the commercial buildings, the courthouse, and you'll see more often than not they're comely and well made. And then go look at the corporate outskirts. You will see more often than not they are comely and well made. Then go look at the corporate outskirts, the chain stores, the fast food joints, the food and fuel stores that no longer can really be called service stations, and the motels, and try to find something comely or well made there. So what's the difference? The difference is that the old town centers were built by people who were proud of their place and who realized a particular value in living there. The old buildings looked good because they were built by people who respected themselves and wanted the respect of their neighbors. The corporate outskirts, on the contrary, were built by people who manifestly take no pride in the place. They see no value in the lives lived there, and they recognize no neighbors. The only value they see in the place is the money that can be siphoned out of it to more fortunate places, and that is to the wealthier suburbs, typically of larger cities. Can we actually suppose that we're wasting, polluting, and making ugly this beautiful land for the sake of patriotism and the love of God? Well, perhaps some of us would like to think so, but in fact, this destruction's taking place because we have allowed ourselves to believe and to live a mated pair of economic lies, that nothing has a value that's not assigned to it by the market, and that the economic life of our communities can safely be handed over to the great corporations. We citizens have a large responsibility for our delusion and our destructiveness, and I don't want to minimize that, but I don't want to minimize either the large responsibility that is borne by government. It is commonly understood that governments are instituted to provide certain protections that citizens individually cannot provide for themselves. But governments have tended to assume that this responsibility can be fulfilled mainly by the police and the military. They've used their regulatory powers reluctantly and often poorly. Our governments have only occasionally recognized the need of land and people to be protected against economic violence. It's true that economic violence is not always as swift, and it's rarely as bloody as the violence of war, but it can be devastating nonetheless. Acts of economic aggression can destroy a landscape or a community or the center of a town or city, and they routinely do so. Such damage is justified by its corporate perpetrators and by their political abettors in the name of the free market and free enterprise. But this is a freedom that makes greed the dominant economic virtue, and it destroys the freedom of other people along with their communities and livelihoods. There are such things as economic weapons of mass destruction. We have allowed them to be used against us, not just by public submission and regulatory malfeasance, but also by public subsidies, incentives, and sufferances that are impossible to justify. We have failed to acknowledge this threat and to act in our own defense. As a result, our once beautiful and bountiful countryside has long been a colony of the coal, timber, and agribusiness corporations, yielding an immense wealth of energy and raw materials at an immense cost to our land and our land's people. Because of that failure also, our towns and cities have been gutted by the likes of Walmart, which have had the permitted luxury of destroying locally owned small businesses by means of volume discounts. Because as individuals, or even as communities, we cannot protect ourselves against these aggressions, we need our state and national governments to protect us. As the poor deserve as much justice from our courts as the rich, so the small farmer and the small merchant deserve the same economic justice, the same freedom in the market as big farmers and chain stores. They should not suffer merely because their rich competitors can afford to undersell them. Furthermore, to permit the smaller enterprises always to be ruined by false advantages, either at home or in the global economy, is ultimately to destroy local, regional, and even national capabilities of producing vital supplies such as food and textiles. It is impossible to understand, let alone justify, a government's willingness to allow the human resources of necessary goods to be destroyed by the freedom of this corporate anarchy. It is equally impossible to understand how a government can permit and even subsidize the destruction of the land and the land's productivity. Somehow we've lost or discarded any controlling sense of the interdependence of the earth and the human capacity to use it well. The governmental obligation to protect these economic resources, inseparably human and natural, is the same as the obligation to protect us from hunger or from foreign invaders. In result, there's no difference between a domestic threat to our resources of our life and a foreign one. And it appears we've fallen into the habit of compromising on issues that should not, and in fact cannot, be compromised. I have an idea that a large number of us, including even a large number of politicians, believe that it is wrong to destroy the earth. But we have powerful political opponents who insist that an earth-destroying economy is justified by freedom and by profit. And so we compromise by agreeing to permit the destruction of only of parts of the earth, or to permit the earth to be destroyed just a little at a time, like the famous three-legged pig that was too well-loved to be slaughtered all at once. The logic of this sort of compromising is clear. And it's clearly fatal. If we continue to be economically dependent on destroying parts of the earth, then eventually we will destroy it all. So long a complaint accumulates a debt to hope, and I would like to end with hope. To do so, I need only repeat something I said at the beginning. Our destructiveness has not been, and it is not, inevitable. People who use that excuse are morally incompetent. They're cowardly and they're lazy. Humans don't have to live by destroying the sources of their life, and people can change. They can learn to do better. All of us, regardless of party, can be moved by the love of our land to rise above the greed and contempt of our land's exploiters. This, of course, leads to practical problems, and I'll offer a short list of practical suggestions. We've got to learn better to respect ourselves and our dwelling places. We need to quit thinking of rural America as a colony. Too much of the economic history of our land has been that of the export of fuel, food, and raw materials that have been destructively and too cheaply produced. We must reaffirm the economic value of good stewardship and good work, and for that we'll need better accounting than we've had so far. We need to reconsider the idea of solving our economic problems by bringing in industry. Every state government appears to be scheming to lure in a large corporation from somewhere else by tax incentives and other squanderings of people's money. And I'm going to interrupt. This is not Wendell Berry now. This is Tana Hartman speaking. North Carolina has been really bad about offering incentives to large corporations that come in, and almost never. There has, in fact, been some study done of this at UNC by a couple of professors that were in the Keenan Business School, I believe, and I'll have to look that up. But these tax incentives rarely are worth what we're giving away. We give away much more than these corporations bring in to us and give us. Anyway, back to Wendell Berry. We ought to suspend that practice until we're sure that in every state we've made the most and the best of what's already there. We need to build the local economies of our communities and our regions by adding value to local products and marketing them locally before we seek markets elsewhere. We need to confront honestly the issue of scale. Now, bigness has a charm and a drama that are seductive, especially to politicians and financiers. But bigness promotes greed, indifference, and damage. And often bigness is not necessary. You may need a large corporation to run an airline or to manufacture cars, but you do not need a large corporation to raise a chicken or a hog. And you do not need a large corporation to process local food or local timber or market it locally. And finally, we need to give an absolute priority to caring well for our land, for every bit of it. There should be no compromise with the destruction of the land or of anything else that we cannot replace. We've been too tolerant of politicians who, entrusted with our country's defense, become the agents of our country's destroyers, compromising on its ruin. And so, I will end by quoting a fellow Kentuckian of Wendell Berry's, a great patriot and an indomitable foe of strip mining. His name's Joe Begley of Blackie. And he says, compromise? Hell. Again, this article comes from the Orion magazine, which I encourage you to look at online, in hard copy too, but it is at www.orionmagazine.org. And this was published in the November-December 2004 issue of that magazine. Another thing I'd like to encourage you to take a look at, Wendell Berry, right after 9/11, published several essays, and those have been collected in a little, in a very slim little volume that is published by Orion. And three of the essays that were published around that time were Thoughts in the Presence of Fear, The Idea of a Local Economy, and In Distrust of Movements. Now, all three of those, as I said, they're available online. Just search for Wendell Berry and you'll find them. But this little book is well worth reading, and I encourage everyone. It was given to me not long after September 11th by some folks who were bringing together others to talk about the negative effects of corporate globalization. I want now to encourage you to remember that the first weekend of the month is the Really, Really Free Market, and it's a monthly community event for sharing goods, skills, services, and ideas, and everything there is absolutely free. Everyone's invited. Bring useful or beautiful things that you can give away, supplies to create something during the event, or just bring your wisdom to share and skills to teach. The event is self-organized by everyone who participates. It's been going on for quite a while now, and it has been a rousing success. Every participant's responsible for the items that they bring that are not taken. And so at the end of it, you bring it. If it's left, you take it away. The Really, Really Free Market, it happens on the first Saturday of each month from 2:30 to 5:30 at the Carborough Town Commons, and it's free and open to the public. So get out there and join it. It really is good, folks. Next thing I want to remind you is that WCOM is a listener-supported community radio station. And without you, without your support, we can't survive. We certainly can't grow. With most of our airwaves dominated today by commercial giants like AT&T and Verizon, supporting our local community radio stations becomes even more important. So whatever it is you care about, whatever the issue is that is really close to your heart, if you don't care too about the media and whether that issue is being fairly covered, then you can't go anywhere. We have too much of our media is dominated by corporate messages. And our local media like WCOM and the People's Channel in Chapel Hill, they give you a chance to put your voices on the air. Every little bit is welcome, every little bit of money or volunteer effort. So to support, whether you want to volunteer to do something or whether you want to donate money, go to www.communityradio.coop. That's www.communityradio.coop. WCOM depends on you to keep the music and the conversation flowing. So please support. WCOM also has opportunities now for local businesses to underwrite a show on the all-volunteer, listener-supported station. There's no commercial clutter. Your message will always be heard and always stand out. So find out more by emailing underwriting@communityradio.coop. Or you can leave a message by phoning the station at 919-929-9601. And I'd like to then, before we close, I want to read to you a couple of other things from Wendell Berry that you might have been able to tell that this is a matter that's close to my heart. I'm really concerned about our dependence on a so-called free market. And as Berry has written, the idea of the free markets, it's just capitalism's so far successful attempt to enlarge the geographic scope of its greed. And it gives to greed the status of a right within its presumptive territory. The global free market's free to corporations precisely because it dissolves the boundaries of old national colonialisms and replaces them with a new colonialism that's without restraints or boundaries. And he uses the metaphor, it's pretty much as if the rabbits were forbidden to have holes, thereby freeing the hounds. The right of a corporation to exercise its economic power without restraint is construed by the partisans of the free market as a form of freedom, a political liberty, implied presumably by the right of individual citizens to use and own property. But the free market idea introduces into government a sanction of an inequality that's not implicit in any idea of democratic liberty, namely that the free market's freest to those who have the most money, and it's not free at all to those with little or no money. Walmart is a very good example of that, and it's the emphasis on producing at a very low cost and selling at the highest cost is what seems to be driving all of this. But remember, a corporation is not a person. A corporation is basically, again, this is what Wendell Berry calls it, and I like this, a pile of money to which a number of persons have sold their allegiance, their moral allegiance. And a corporation's primary goal is just to become a bigger pile of money. Stockholders are essentially usurers. They're people who let their money work for them, and they expect high pay in return for causing others to work for low pay. And this is a big problem. It's seriously implicated in our bad economy. We're going to talk more as time goes on about economics on the program. We're going to get some people in here who are looking at economics from different perspectives. But right now, the way that economics works, last weekend we interviewed Shai Tamari here, and one of the things he said that struck me was he was talking about Americans' type of capitalism is a competitive and destructive capitalism, and he said that that won't work in other places. I don't think it'll work here, but that's another matter. That places like the Middle East need a more cooperative capitalism, and the way our capitalism seems to be working is it's competition, all based on competition, and the law of competition is basically the law of war. Global economies based on cheap long-distance transportation. You move goods from the point of cheapest origin to the point of highest sale. And in the process, local production capacities, local diversity, and local economic independence are often destroyed. The propaganda is that's subscribed to and distributed by most political leaders and editorial writers and even other opinion makers is this idea of a global free market economy with all of its obvious moral flaws and its dangerous practical weaknesses, but it's the ruling orthodoxy of our age. And it's institutionalized in the World Trade Organization, which was set up without any election to rule international trade on behalf of the free market, and which is to say, on behalf of supranational corporations, and to overrule in secret sessions any national or regional law that conflicts with the free market. The idea of a local economy rests on two principles, neighborhood and subsistence. In a viable neighborhood, which I have to say we seem to have right here in Carrboro, it's doing pretty well. I'm very impressed with what Carrboro does and how vital this local community is. But in a viable neighborhood, neighbors ask themselves what they can do or provide for each other. And they find the answers that they and their place can afford. This is the practice of neighborhood. The practice must be, in part, charitable, but it also must be economic, and the economic part must be equitable. And there is, as Barry reminds us, a significant charity in just prices. So, support local businesses. Support your local media, including WCOM, and go to www.trianglewilf.org, and you can get some more information about a number of very important issues. And one more that I want to say, and I should have said earlier, is the Community for Environmental Legal Defense. This is a tremendous organization that around the country is working with local communities to help them rethink and reclaim their local sovereignty. So, and that is celdf.org. Thank you for being with us today. We are coming to you from WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro, and this is your local and all volunteer and listener supported radio station. Thank you. You've been listening to the Wilf Show, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And next week, our guest is going to be... Who is that? I forgot. I should have looked it up before, but let me look here. Next week, our guest is Melissa Radcliffe from the Children's Place. So tune in then, and have a great week.